last.
This is in solidarity with
739
staff. There are a bunch of legislative assistants that wanted to wear a waterfall knot today. I think it was horrible.
Committee members?
This is me.
I see Carter's wearing one.
Hit the gavel. Pat, yeah. You're on the record.
Yeah. Fantastic. I was hoping it would.
People can hear you.
Blue jeans.
I'm right here, you know, when you're talking about me.
Okay, good morning, committee members and friends in the audience. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 292. Jan, give us... Oh, I went to the wrong one.
Well, that's okay.
Okay, two. I was supposed to get Jason's first. No, go ahead, Susan. Senator, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Please give us your testimony.
Co-Chair Wisnett and Co-Chair Holby and committee members, thank you so much for holding this hearing today. I'm Senator Suzanne Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17, which is in Washington and Multnomah counties. Thank you again for scheduling a hearing on Senate Bill 292, which deals with free trial offers. Now, if you have listened to the radio, watched television, or been online lately, you have probably seen or heard about a free trial offer. Interested in losing a little weight? Want to improve your memory? Get rid of those wrinkles? Those are some of the things that you might hear about with a free trial offer. And what happens sometimes in these free trial offers is that a consumer will either call the toll-free number, log on to get information, and when calling the phone number, what could happen is that they might reach a recording saying, "You're one of the lucky ones. You've reached us in time to get the free trial offer. Please enter your address and name and credit card number." And that could be on a recording without anyone there to answer questions about, what am I getting for this in this free trial offer? People assume that they're paying, entering their credit card number and paying for shipping and handling, but they don't know how much that's going to be necessarily. They don't know what they're going to get and how many times a shipment will be sent. And sometimes they could end up receiving, for example, monthly boxes of magic berry pills that will help them lose weight. And then it's very hard for them to get out of the deal. That is one of the possibilities with a free trial offer. Another that you'll hear about today from Karen Garst, who's here to testify about her son's experience. So he signed up to get something, a particular product, and ended up being billed for something else as well. He was expecting to get a free trial of something and ended up with a monthly charge on his debit card bill. So what happens in Senate Bill 292, which I was very pleased to say went... sailed through the Senate with only one person absent, and everyone else thought this was a great bill, committees. What happens under Senate Bill 292 is that consumers are entitled to get information before they're financially obligated. It doesn't stop free trial offers. We think they have a place in our marketplace, but this says that they can get the information about what it will cost and what they will get before they're obligated. It also requires affirmative consumer assent to being charged for a different product. And finally, it has provisions that allow the consumer a method to cancel if they want to cancel the free trial offer. So it's really a disclosure bill and clarification that will let consumers know ahead of time what they're getting, what it will cost, allows them to cancel, and just requires that they say yes if they're going to be billed for something other than the product that they think they're getting. Colleagues, we think this is a great bill for consumers, especially in these difficult times when every dollar counts for our families here in Oregon. And one thing I wanted to clarify is that this is the result of a work group that happened. We started working on this bill in the 2009 session, and then over the interim, I had a work group that was staffed by committee staff in the Senate side. We had consumer groups, the Department of Justice, several communications companies, and the Direct Marketing Association, and Tech America. So we had a lot of people around the table as we crafted this bill, appreciated their input, and made a lot of changes on the way to address concerns that were raised during the work group process. And thank you again for having this hearing here today. I hope that you'll move the bill onto your House floor with a due pass recommendation. And I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Senator, for bringing this. Committee members, we have some other people who are going to be testifying on this bill, and we plan to, I'd like to close this public hearing and move to the other senators so we can get them back to work, and we want Senator Bonamici to go work on the redistricting for Jason and myself. Do look at that real close.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair. Co-Chair Hovey.
Thank you for bringing it forth, Senator. We're going to close the public hearing on, do you close it and recess?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 292A. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. Do you want to summarize it first, Jan?
I will, Mr. Sheriff, committee members. This is a bill that requires legislative administrator to maintain reports of witnesses who testify on measures and then post those reports on the legislative website. And there are no amendments before you.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you for bringing this bill, and would you give us your testimony?
Thank you very much.
And, identify yourself, sir.
Thank you for agreeing to hear this bill. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson. I represent a good portion of Southern Oregon. This bill is a very simple bill, but the more we started to work on it, the more sense it made. As we talk in this, the last series of campaigns and in all the things that we do, especially in the Rules Committee, we talk about the word transparency and accountability, and we get into government where a word has more power if it ends in BLY. But this bill is a very simple measure to update something that most citizens have no idea what happens, and that is to use a device, not that I'm sponsored by Apple, but an iPad, something like an iPad, here in our committee rooms, so that when everyone testifies, the people who testify for bills, citizens, lobbyists, contract lobbyists, all are automatically posted on the web so that the public can see who is testifying on what bills and why. And that is simply what the bill does. And we think it's very important, especially as we have now television and web streaming. We have bill history and bills all posted online. But yet the one mystery is, who are all these people who are testifying, or how come bills don't have anyone testifying, or how come the executive branch testifies on so many bills? I think that is it's a very small piece of legislation. I think it has a tremendous amount of potential for better government, and I would urge an aye vote.
Thank you very much, Senator. I don't have the sign up, but are there other people going to be testifying on this? Do you want to take any questions, or do you want
to... I'd be delighted to do whatever you would like to have
any
me
any questions
do.
Of Senator...
No one else
has. Okay, no one else has signed up, so does anyone have questions?
So
Representative Clem.
Just to confirm the way it would look in the end, somebody testifies... I'm trying to think. There's been several times where I heard somebody said something, and then I had to listen to an hour and a half scanning every few minutes on the series of tubes known as the internet to see if I could figure out who in fact or who it was and where. So there'd just be there'd be an electronic version of everybody in order as they testified.
Right.
You just look at it. You think they would do the minute even when they started, or just names in order?
Well, I know Mr. Burgess is here to answer any technical questions. I think it's up for us to decide. But I'll tell you, I mean, it's fascinating to me that if you get some of these highly emotional bills that we get so often, where lobbyists are hired ad nauseum and paid huge amounts of money to do various things to bills, good or bad, often bad, that the public has no idea who they are and why they're testifying, and how it's funny. I've been working on this book of funny quotes and sayings and language that we use around the Capitol, and one of the ones that's so amazing to me is appearing before you today as. Nobody in the real world knows what appearing before you today as means. And so what this bill does is simply, I think, allows people to see, in my opinion, how few citizens testify, how we do, the legislature goes out of its way to take testimony from people who live over 100 miles away first, how hard chairs work to go opposing viewpoints on bills, I think that is a good demonstration of how we do work. But at the same time, I don't think people have a full grasp of how many agencies are lobbying bills and testifying before or against, and how much money there is being spent to pass or kill bills. And I think that's really what I'm getting at.
That's a great bill.
Good. Any other questions, committee members? Representative Sheehan.
I guess it's more of a comment. I'm concerned that this just does something that's already there with the audio record. And what you're describing sounds awesome. I would love the ability to be able to go in and click a name of somebody and have all of their items come up. I'm wondering if maybe this could be strengthened to have that sort of mechanism built into it so that it's organized in a database or it directs them to do something where it's where there's some more technology behind it, I guess, to allow the public to access the information as you describe it, because this seems to me to just have what's already out there as an audio recording right now.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Waterfall, I mean...
thank you, Senator Searsucker Soup.
That's right.
That was from yesterday.
You're absolutely correct. I think that's a brilliant point. I think purposely... given the change in space, the change in speed of technology, I kept it broad. I think if there's something to add, if in the collective wisdom of the committee to add something to it, that's more than welcome. I think this is a very interesting bipartisan, bicameral thing that we can do. I would say that the legislative... Excuse me while I turn around. What's the name of the committee? Legislative... Administration Committee. Thank you. I think there's all kinds of flexibility in that committee to make sure that, you know, it's most responsive. In the very brief time that I've been in the legislature, the video recordings didn't work very good. No one picked them up. Cable access wasn't what it was. The internet was... certainly didn't work very well. The website that the legislature has was cumbersome, but everybody's was at that time. And the carpet in the Senate was orange. So, you know, a lot of good things have changed, and I think that would be, however we do it, would be fine. I mean, I think we're going to get to some very good streaming at some point.
Okay. Any other questions, committee members? Thank you very much, Senator, for bringing this forth. And,
thank you very much. Thank you for getting me in front of the deacon.
I'm going to have to make a comment to now cover myself in doing that, but thank you, Senator. Have a good day. Work hard for the people. Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739, and we'll open public hearing. Can we do these both together, or should we do? We'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 29 and Senate Bill 30, and ask Senator Monroe to come up. Can give us a brief summary of these two bills, please.
Mr. Chair's committee members, Senate Bill 29 adds the historic cemeteries operated by nonprofit organizations to a list of cemeteries that are exempt from specified laws that apply to private cemeteries. And Senate Bill 30 requires Endowment Care Cemetery to deposit in an endowment care fund at least 9% of the gross sales price of a grave sold with a grave liner installed at the time of the sale. And it clarifies that cemetery may deposit more than the minimum required in the endowment care fund.
Good morning, Senator Monroe. And I guess since the other senators are gone, we save the best to last. Is that what we should say?
Good morning. Thank you. Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, East Portland and Happy Valley. And thank you very much for hearing these two bills this morning. I have with me, and you'll hear from them later, Ty Cochran, who owns a historic, or who operates a historic cemetery in Hood River. And I think the head of the Cemetery Association is also here today, so they will fill in details that I won't give you. The first measure relates to historic cemeteries that are privately owned, and current law, if they have any plots still for sale, current law requires them to have a plotting and platting and surveying of the entire historic cemetery, and that's virtually impossible. You got talking about graves that are over 100 years old, and it's just not possible to accurately define exactly the parameters sometimes. So this would give them an exemption from that. Senate Bill 30 has to do with the fact that currently cemeteries are beginning to sell plots that are pre-lined so that the cement lining is already in the ground. And, of course, that makes it more expensive. And so it's probably not reasonable to charge the same amount for perpetuity for maintaining the grounds when you sell a more expensive plot that already has the liner in it as the amount that you would deposit for just bare ground. Currently, if it's just bare ground, normal cemetery plot, they're required to put aside 15% in a deposit, and that's used in perpetuity to maintain the grounds. But since the plot with a liner in it is more expensive, it wouldn't be necessary to have that amount of money, because it doesn't take any, it's not any more difficult to maintain a plot with a liner in it than one that isn't, doesn't have a liner in it. It's just it costs more, and so it reduces the amount to 9% for those. Again, thank you for hearing these two bills. They both I carried both of them on the floor of the Senate. They both passed the Senate unanimously, and they had long hearings in over on the Senate side. There are gentlemen here that can explain these bills in detail and answer any of your questions, and I'm going to be hustling off to Ways and Means. I'd be happy to answer questions, though.
Thank you very much, Senator, for bringing these forth, and we'll look forward to the other testimony, and please go save us money.
Thank you.
And find some more for education.
Yes, that's what that's my job.
Have a good day, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Mr. Farrell, Tim Farrell, and Ty Cochran. You want to come up together? Good morning. Welcome to your capital, and please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Thank you. Tim Farrell of 1235 Tucker Road, Hood River, Oregon. I'm the Secretary of the Cemetery Association of Oregon and President of the Mountain View Memorial Cemetery in Hood River.
You want to go ahead and give us your testimony first, and we'll go to the next.
Yes, sir. Please. Yes. Right. As I said, I live in Hood River, and we have a historic cemetery there. I understand that some of you may have been there and know the area. My history with Hood River, I've been going in and out of there for the past 20 years. I was corporate counsel for a telecoms firm for many years, and then did some pro bono lobbying work in Washington, D.C., and ended up back in Hood River, where I had been involved with this cemetery since 1991. And an interesting issue came up, which is the platting of these cemeteries, which is required by Oregon state law. Now, if you're not officially platted as to subdivision standards, which is quite precise, it's a misdemeanor and punishable by up to a year in jail. So there's significant punishment for not complying with the law. As Senator Monroe said, though, a historic cemetery such as ours, 1888, it's very difficult to locate a lot of these graves. And in addition, the property lines, I, for instance, have three different surveys that show I have three different property lines, none of which comports with where my roads are laid out and so on. So in order to comply with the law, I would have to do a boundary line adjustment, which would be very expensive to get court approval. And then, of course, I would have to get the survey to go out and locate many of these graves, which could be extremely difficult because of the change technology and so on over the years in locating graves. This is not a law, though, that even though it's good, it's good to have planning so that genealogists can find historic graves, so that families can go out and do so, and so on. It's not an absolute. Church cemeteries are exempt, county-owned cemeteries are exempt, and indeed, cemeteries owned by fraternal organizations are also exempt from this requirement. Our cemetery, for example, was owned by the Knights of Pythias, a fraternal organization, which no longer has a lodge in Hood River. So, and I think that this is kind of a sign of the times. These fraternal organizations are less involved, so private individuals have had to step up and form nonprofits and so on in order to manage these properties. And there's kind of been created a gap in the law that I think that it was intended back in the 50s or 60s, whenever this legislation was drafted, that these types of cemeteries would be exempt from such a requirement, but nobody thought that things would change as they have done, such that groups like mine have come into the fore to take over these properties. So, for example, in my area, there's 4 acres total. I've got 2 acres. Another acre is owned by the Catholic cemetery, which is exempt, and another adjacent property is owned by the county, which is also exempt. But the whole property is actually owned by the Knights of Pythias, which would have been exempt, but now, since we're a nonprofit historic cemetery, we have to comply with this. But I think it makes sense to make us exempt in light of the history and the changes in the law and in the practice that's been done. And I think it lifts kind of a regulation that's not really so much needed in this context, and it allows people to come in and volunteer their time and hopefully resurrect, if you will, some of these cemeteries that have kind of been abandoned out there, but which people have feared to get involved with because of this misdemeanor liability if they don't go out and first plat before doing the work to get the cemetery up and functioning.
Thank you, sir. Committee members, you're testifying, Mr. Farrell, on Senate Bill 29.
Correct.
And Mr. Cochran did not sign up for that. Did you want to testify on 29? So, committee members, I think this is good. Do you have questions for Mr. Farrell on Senate Bill 29? And then we'll go to Mr. Cochran. Any questions about the historical? We have an interesting one on my golf course in Sun River. Historical graveyard, and you get the pre-drop. You don't have to play out of the, the crossfire. Representative Clem.
Did you say which cemetery on Tucker Road?
Mountain View Memorial. We're next to the county cemetery, the Westside Fire Department.
Idlewild's the one that's on Brookside, Idlewild.
Correct.
That's where my wife's family's all.
Correct, yes. There's
the next one up around the next corner. Yeah. If you keep going up Tucker. North.
And that's a Mason-owned cemetery, and they're exempt from this law.
Just one point. I've been reading this Templar book. Are anybody in the Masons or Pythias involved with the Knights Templar also?
It's all the same thing, man.
Okay. Illuminati.
Thank you for that question.
I'm not all the same thing.
Sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Farrell, is there, like, can a one grave be a historical cemetery?
There are. We did go through the process to get a historic designation, and we did base that on Nathaniel Coe, who is the founder of the county. So I the answer would be yes to that. Yes, sir.
And is there, and I'm assuming that there's not many graves in a historic. We're not talking about a lot of land here that's going to be off the tax rolls for cities or counties or something.
Well, we're already a nonprofit, so that. We are exempt already from paying those taxes.
Okay.
This would not influence that.
Okay. Any other questions on Senate Bill 29, committee members? Okay, very good. So, Mr. Cochran, do you want to start, or Mr. Farrell, you want to start on Senate Bill 30? Because you both signed up for that.
I would like to introduce Mr. Cochran and then be here for...
Thank you. Please. Please give us your name. So, good morning.
Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm with the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I also am the general manager of Bellcrest Memorial Park here in Salem, Oregon. I submitted some electronic version of written testimony to you a couple days ago. I want to clarify that there, in the last paragraph of that, I had to revise that with your new printed material that was given to you this morning. Totally my fault. The DCBS apparently Division of Finance Corporate Securities, who regulate the endowment care financial part of our industry. They, in my original version, I said that they supported the bill. I was corrected by them immediately after that to where they have no objection to the bill. They actually helped us draft the bill.
Thank you for making that clear, Sue. They have no opposition, is that
correct? That is correct.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that.
Members of the committee, the last 20 years, many cemeteries throughout the United States and Oregon have what they call pre-installed lawn crypts. And essentially what it is they excavate a large portion of ground and put in the concrete burial containers or some other kind of burial container that the actual casket fits in. Years ago, as you know, in regular graves, there's a state requirement for a certain percentage of the gross selling price to go into the endowment care fund if you're an endowment care cemetery. The problem lies now with a cemetery that has these pre-installed, of course, the expense is going to be higher because you already have this concrete liner that the family needs to purchase to place the casket in, and it was never addressed. The endowment care portion was never addressed. So, as an example, cemetery has a pre-installed grave, pre-installed liner in a grave, and they sell it for $3,000. It was up to the cemetery at that time to break that out and say, okay, the grave we sold for $1,000, and we paid 15% on the grave, and we sold the liner for $2,000, and we don't have to pay endowment care on merchandise in the cemetery. As we ask all of our members in the Cemetery Association and even non-members that are operating cemeteries that had these pre-installed lawn crypts, we found out that everyone was doing it different. Some people would pay 15% on the $3,000 because they just didn't understand. Well, the law was silent on it, essentially. We drafted a bill, took it to Legislative Council, and they came back and said, why don't you just pay 9% across the board on the entire package? When we looked at other states and what they did when they addressed this, which almost every other state has, Oregon, kind of our fault, we're the ones that should have been doing this as the industry leaders. We came up with a figure of 9%, and that coincides with, you know, the 5% on mausoleum crypts compared to the 15%. So it's a level playing field for everyone. And, of course, like I say, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities is fine with this. It would make their job easier when they go out and do the audits to say, hey, you know, because everyone was all over the board with it. So, really, it's a cleanup of the changing industry.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Committee members, questions for Mr. Cochran? Is anyone here from Department of Consumer and Business Services that worked on this? Okay, no committee. Thank you very much. No questions. Looks like you addressed your bill very well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Okay, we had the lady from Oregon Health and Science University has a meeting downtown. Could we go ahead and work that one? See what kind of, are you okay? We're going to work Senate Bill 392.
Yeah, I have to leave at 9, so...
The last one, then we're going to vote.
Okay.
Committee members, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 29 and Senate Bill 30. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 392. Jan, refresh us on where we are on this bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the bill that continues to exempt from the disclosure of public records until January 2nd of 2016 the names, home addresses, professional addresses, and locations of persons engaged in or that supply goods and services for medical research at OHSU involving animals other than rodents. The committee heard the bill a week ago. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact either.
Thank you very much. Did we have anyone else here to talk on this? Committee members, we have a bill before us. Representative Chair Hovey, you want to?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 392 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Hovey moves Senate Bill 392 to the floor of a due pass recommendation. Discussion, committee members?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was hoping to get OHSU to say a couple things on the record. We communicated last night and was hoping to get a couple things on the record before we pass the bill.
Thank you. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman.
Mrs. Phillips, you want to identify yourself? And
good morning.
Good morning.
Co-Chair Holby, Co-Chair Wisnant, my name is Janet Billups, B-I-L-L-U-P-S, in-house legal counsel for the Oregon Health and Science University. I'm happy to answer any question.
Thanks.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the, as we discussed last time with the bill, and I am in a general way very supportive, the key question is balancing the really legitimate interest in protecting the safety of researchers at the Primate Center with also ensuring, you know, some proper level of transparency and sunlight-driven scrutiny of practices to make sure we're doing everything the best we can do it. And as I said before, the reason we do sunsets, there's a question coming, I promise. The reason we do sunsets is so that we can evaluate if we are striking the right balance. If the laws we are passing are accomplishing the objectives that we set out to do. The reason, and I remember this very specifically, that in Judiciary Committee last session, we asked for a short sunset was so that we could evaluate more closely. And as I recall, in 2004, there was a lawsuit where the records request was made. It hadn't been complied with by OHSU. OHSU charged $12,000 to $151,000 for the fees. The Court of Appeals said the fees were excessive. This bill came out of that. One of the good things about the bill is it makes it easier for OHSU to provide records without feeling like they're putting anybody in danger. What I wanted to get on the record from you was that was to hear your willingness and commitment to return to your practice of tracking the public record requests to the Primate Center, and that the or to track when this particular public records exemption is a possibility, whether or not you use that exemption, and to keep a detailed enough report so the legislature and the public will understand when and how you've used or not used this exemption. I'm trying to use the same words I used in the email yesterday to your ABLE advocacy team. Want to make sure that is good for you, that works, and that we can make that happen so that when we review this at the sunset, we can evaluate even a little better how well we're striking that balance.
Co-chairs Wisnant and Holvey, Representative Smith, I may have gotten a little wrapped up and confused in the at the last hearing with formatting and how we format our track record of records requests. We do, in fact, keep track of every records request that comes in and how we handle it. Whether it's a log or something else, we keep track of it. We will commit to you to continue to keep track of it in a format that reports when we have received requests of this nature and when we've used this law, and we'll do it in a manner that the legislature and members of the general public who are interested can have access to that information whenever they request.
Thanks, Chair Phillip.
Yes, please.
And could I also ask, and hope to get your commitment, that in the provision of that information, it is done in a way, as I've seen some of the logs have been really helpful, right, where it's pretty easy to understand, that get your commitment to do it in a way that is not bearing in so much information that only Sherlock Holmes with a lot of time can understand or communicate it in a way that you know, even addled brains can understand pretty well.
Yes.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Good. Other comments or questions, committee members? Representative Smith, I appreciate your work on that and clarifying that, and I think that's good questions, and I appreciate the response from the hospital. Thank you. Have a safe trip to your meeting.
Thank you.
Other questions, committee members? If not, we'll have a vote. Tamara, please call the roll.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Clunn?
Yep.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Co-Chair Holby?
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnant?
Aye. Motion carries. Well, anyone want to carry that? Representative Smith, are you interested in doing that? Or not?
You'd be a great one.
I'd be happy to carry whatever. At the chair's pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Smith. I appreciate it. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 392. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. Jen, please summarize this bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the bill that requires the legislative administrator to maintain reports of witnesses who testify on measures and to report those on the legislative website. And there are no amendments before you.
Thank you very much. And I think we have several people signed up. Mr.
Questions.
Questions. This is one we heard from. Yeah. Oh, I think we need to have Mr. Burgess up. I'm sure there'll be some questions. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Committee members, this is the one that the bill that Senator Atkinson gave us testimony on. There were a couple of questions for him, and I didn't bring up Mr. Burgess because I was trying to get through our senators. So do you have any comments, Mr. Burgess, you'd like to add to them? Testimony by Senator Atkinson.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. Scott Burgess, legislative administrator. Good morning. I'm here to answer questions. I think we're clear on the intent of the bill as it's written. You know that there's a minimal fiscal impact submitted on this in terms of the way the bill is written. Some of the discussion by the senator I understand the goal probably goes beyond our capability at this time and would require additional financial outlay. But in terms of the desire, as I understand it, again, the agency has no position on the bill, and just for clarification, and I don't want anybody to misunderstand our capabilities at this point, not that they can't be improved over time. But the idea that we'd have a tablet of some sort that could automatically send that up to the web is not in our capability at this time. And I have your chief information officer here, Chancey Sabin, manager of information services, if you want to get into some technical discussions. And obviously your committee services manager, Rick Berkovian, is here as well. But as it stands now and as be written, as you know, we implemented just this session, in the 2009 session, there was some discussion about the log, CourtSmart, that you have that does the audio. During this session, have been able to take committee exhibits, testimony, whatever, and put those on the web and make that available to the members and to the public. This would essentially be, we would take the sign-up sheet and make that exhibit and include that in the exhibits to the web. That's how we would see it at this point. Over time, we may be able to come more electronic, faster, etc., in terms of this information. But I just wanted to make sure the committee understands the way our capabilities at this point and how the fiscal note was brought about. So if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. So your testimony is that the bill is, it's written, that you're able to do that without a financial impact.
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct.
Okay. But some of the things I think that Senator Atkins was hoping and we hope for the future would have a financial impact.
Mr. Co-Chair, just to clarify, we have a number of efforts in information services that we are working on or will work on in the next biennium. Again, we can get into more detail, but the electronic bill documentation, which is a major enterprise solution, which would start improving our ability to sort of tie this organization together in terms of information, a central repository of all information related to bills, is a major effort that we have that would need to be completed to include this kind of information. As you know, we have a website that was developed in 1999, and that is another major effort that we have underway to totally redesign that website, which is also be useful in terms of making this kind of information more available not only to the members but to the public. So those are efforts underway. We're getting there, but we just want to make sure we're clear that some of the ideas might be ahead of our capabilities at this point.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions, committee members? Representative Clem.
So if I recall right, and I'm just wondering about the history, and you may not know it either, but I believe at one time there were kind of minutes kept, written minutes. I've done some searches before and popped up notes of which witnesses and kind of what they said that were clearly written, and I assume we just must have stopped doing that at some point once, you know, for money reasons or something, or maybe we did that before audio, and then, you know, once we had audio, we no longer did it. But that was the way you could kind of scan and find
witnesses.
You want to
come up, please?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Clem asked Rick Berkovian to come up. Certainly been around a little longer than I, and also in the detail of that, I did make some reference to CourtSmart, and that may have something to do with in terms of the logging of specifically what's being said in committee by person, by time, whatever. But I don't know if you want
to have something to add. For the record, Rick Berkovian, Manager of Committee Services. Chair and members, Representative Clem's making reference to we used to do summary logs years ago where after a hearing, staff would go back and they'd have the assistant do a summary of that hearing. It was decided by both desks, maybe 03-ish, that the audio log with a tape, then a tape log would suffice. And so the audio accompanied by a log of who's talking when are the actual documents that serve as our official record. And it was the fact that we did summations of the hearings. It was rather tedious and it had to be done manually after each hearing.
Follow up,
yeah. So there is already a log available to the public of who's talking and when?
Yeah, can I?
Yeah.
No idea of this.
I'm submitting a handout. There is a log that accompanies, and one of the handouts you're getting here will show you. And when we did the fiscal analysis of this bill, it was based on the fact we could post this document on our website along with the witness sign-up sheet. I'll wait till you get that. This would be our lower tech accommodation to this bill. As you can see, the log, that this is just an example of House Rules, one page of it, actually accompanies the audio log so that as you're going through the hearing, if you can compare it side by side, you can see then, for example, at 311, you know, co-chair Jim Stembridge spoke, and you'd have to then compare that to the audio log. So the written log you see is just simply a time stamp of who spoke when. If you went on further, you'd see where a motion would be made. And this is an incompleted one. So, for example, at 341, it'd show the motion, do pass is amended. The other document you have is something you've probably all seen before. It's the actual sign-up sheet that we have. And these necessarily are not posted on our website. Both these documents could be posted to, in our opinion, address and meet the low-tech requirements of Senate Bill 739.
Okay. Other committee questions? Representative Cameron, you have
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, because my concern was, now that you handed this other document, was that I know this is a sign-up sheet, but there's many times when people aren't even signed up, but they're called up anybody else, and I'm not sure that everybody gets added to this particular list, but this would have the documentation. So what you're saying is today this is not posted on the website.
No.
However, if you do a request for a record, you would get this.
Yes, sir.
So, all right.
Thank you. Other questions? Chair Hovey?
Thank you. I this was on here. Just so I'm clear, this is the information you're proposing under this legislation to put on the web. Would be this log.
Chair members, yes, that's our, that would be scanned the witness sheet. The recording log is already produced in a Word PDF document, and we would post it on there to accompany our web pages, exhibits.
Follow up.
Sure, please.
So can you clarify for me, because I'm a little bit concerned or a little bit confused, perhaps one of the two or maybe both, about the minimal fiscal that you referred to and about the other things that we're talking about implementing that I'm guessing aren't under this bill. So right now it shows a minimal fiscal, and I'm just concerned about that, and then I have a follow-up question about the cost.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and members. Since we already scan and receive a lot of information digitally and put it up on our web pages, these would just be two more documents that we would produce or scan and put up on our web pages as part of our routine duties. It doesn't require any more technological.
I'm not sure we need these.
It's already there.
I don't think you need the second one, like the Representative Cameron said, because this is not, that will save you some work. Just do this one. I mean,
it already is.
It's already there.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying, is we don't need the second one, right?
No, just a point of clarification. I mean, Representative Clem here just pulled up your.
What?
There's Representative Hovey had the floor. Is that
good? Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I'll yield.
It's friendly. It's good conversation.
No, go ahead.
We just pulled it up on the website. You already can get this.
Chair members, which website are you pulling up?
Go ahead. I had no idea this was here until right now. I'm very excited about all this. I went on just the ledge.state.or.us, and I went into committees, and then committee minutes from 9109, and then you go into, it says tape logs. And then you just go in, and basically all of these are there for every committee already.
They're not, Chair and members, they're not always tagged on our committee web page with our exhibits. Not every committee's doing that. I think we're doing revenue and finance committees are putting their tape logs up there each time. It's just not been a normal operation that we've done, which we could easily institutionalize for all of our committees.
Chair Helby, you want to do your follow-up?
I apologize.
Well, that's good. I'm just kind of worried that we're implementing Senate bills before they've passed, if these are already being done. But just kidding. So anyway, I'm just trying to get to the bottom that this isn't going to create a fiscal impact, and it's very small, and then if any. And the second part of my question, could you explain to me the part of this bill and I think it's part of existing legislation, talks about the monies received, the costs incurred, and talk to me about how the costs and who are the costs to, and who's I guess you're charging the general fund, or exactly how are the money received under Section 4 of this section are continuously appropriated? So what costs are being collected?
Co-chairs.
Or being received. And I mean, how does this fee work?
That language is existing language and basically allows us to charge for requested publications, including hard copies of bills. For example, the lobby signs up and gets a bill pack, and we charge them.
Okay.
We've moved, since this legislation's been written, and most of this is addressed in rules, House and Senate rules, in terms of how the charges would be to members or others, and it rests in this. We do the publications in legislative administration. We follow the members in terms of House and Senate rules, in terms of what's being charged. But, for example, lobby signs up for bill packets, and we charge for that. Obviously, for members, that comes out of your budgets. And because we've moved so far into paperless, we're doing less and less of that. So that's existing language. We don't see anything related specifically to this bill that would bring that in. That's why the minimal fiscal impact. And the reason I just, for clarification, in the senator's testimony, he was referring to iPads, tablets. that would essentially replace your sign-up sheet, and that could automatically push a button and it would go away. We just don't have that capability, and that would generate probably, you know, not that it can't be done, it's just not possible right now. So as we understand it, as Mr. Bacobian indicated, how we would implement this bill should it pass in a minimal fiscal impact, and that we have other projects underway in information services which would improve our capability to make information more readily available to members and to citizens in the future, specifically trying to do away with things like OneNote that would make it more available information, legislative information, to everybody.
All right, that helps me. So it's old, addressing the old paper copies. So you're not going to be charging our legislative offices for the website access. Okay, good.
No. I have a concern. I think this is good, and I think the purpose of the bill is good. Representative Conger and I have a lot of people that live a long way and are not able to come all the time, and we always tell them, submit your testimony. I think, Rick, what we could probably do is be sure that all committees end or during the or beginning of the bill, they make acknowledgement of testimony received, and that would be on this log, but we don't always do that. So that would, for those people that think, you know, they want to be sure that their word's being heard and they can't always get here physically, that it would be sure that committee chairs and with the administrator acknowledge all submitted testimony that are not they're not here in person but have submitted written testimony. I think you could probably do that in just instructions to the committees or something, but I think that would be a good Representative Hovey has people a long way up too that could may want to be submitted testimony for the issues but cannot be here. So is that any comment on that?
Chair members, yeah, that would be, there are times when chairs will also keep the record open after the hearing ends. A lot of people show up, they can't testify, the chair will say we'll keep the record open until a set date so that anything received becomes an official exhibit versus just an email or a letter received. But if chairs, and again, we always have to defer to the chair of the committee, if he or she says I'll continue to receive the information at a certain date or I read into the record a document, then it becomes an official exhibit.
That'd be good training or instructions for your committee administrators to be sure the chairs do that, so it acknowledges those inputs. Thank you. Any other questions, committee members? Hey, good testimony. Thank you. Okay, where am I? Okay, so we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 292A. Jen, this is the one committee members that Senator Bonamici introduced, and we'll now have people signed up for this one. Do I have it? I may have it. Do I have it? I have it. No. It's one of my files here. You got yours, Paul?
Excuse me?
We got it. Here we go. Okay, here we go.
There's yours.
Okay, looks like everyone's for it, so that's good. Mr. Dubanovich, Mr. Bethanamo, and let's bring those up. Karen Garst, want to come up to him? Good morning. I thought I did pretty good on that four syllable word.
Good morning.
Good morning.
President.
Good morning, sir. Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
My name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff to Attorney General Kroger and Special Counsel at the Department of Justice. This bill, as you'll remember, deals with promotional and free offers, and there is no doubt that those kind of offers are good for consumers and good for businesses as they bring the two together on certain occasions. The challenges that we face, however, is the lack of disclosures and the number of times that consumers unwittingly get into what they think is a free transaction but end up being charged substantially. In our consumer complaint database, we code these issues in a number of different ways, so it's fairly difficult to precisely identify the number of complaints that we receive, but I think it's fair to say that we've gotten over 150 complaints in 2010 alone, focusing on what consumers believed were free offers. We also, as you may recall, have a consumer educator that goes around the state to help consumers avoid scams and make sure that they use their precious dollars reasonably. And what she reports is that after complaints involving telecommunications companies and mortgage modification problems, free offers are the thing that people come to her most often about. And virtually everybody in the state, in all regions, young and old, rich and poor, urban and rural, everybody in the state has some story to tell about a free offer. Now, many of these complaints stem from what people perceive to be a simple, straightforward online transaction. You sign up, not sign up, but you actually enter into a transaction on a website thinking that you're going to purchase a product from company X. And unbeknownst to the consumer, what happens is something called data pass. The credit card information and your name and address gets passed on to a completely different company. And they then provide you what you perceive to be maybe a free product, but then they start charging you for that product after a certain period of time. And a lot of consumers enter into those transactions with absolutely no knowledge whatsoever that they are becoming obligated to purchase a product. I've prepared a written testimony that was submitted to you via email, I believe, and one of the attachments to my written testimony is a description of a particular product called Pain Vanish. And as an aging athlete, if there is such a successful product, I would have bought it by the case. But unfortunately, we've received dozens of complaints about this product, and here's why. Not necessarily whether it works or doesn't work, but people sign up for what they believe to be a free tube of Pain Vanish. You see the advertisement, it says free trial offer. Great. Somebody sends the information in. Usually you have to provide credit card information to cover shipping and handling. So people perceive, okay, I'll pay the $2.95 for the shipping and handling, but I'm getting a free tube of this Pain Vanish cream. What is really hidden in the fine details is if you don't cancel after the first tube, they'll send another one to you for $14.99 plus shipping and handling. And even more amazing is if you don't cancel after the second tube, they'll continue to send you additional tubes of Pain Vanish at $24.99 plus shipping and handling for the rest of your life until you cancel. Now the problem here is that by the time you've gotten a couple of these tubes and finally it showed up on your credit card bill, it's a couple of months out. And now you've got the tubes that you no longer want and you want to cancel. So to add pain to your misery, so to speak, you now need to cancel. But if you go to the advertisement, you'll find that it's very difficult to cancel because they will either not tell you how to cancel, or they won't provide you a toll-free number, or there'll be no web address for you to go to cancel. So what consumers express to us time and time again is, okay, I get it, I got suckered in, I'll pay for the first tube. Maybe I'll pay for the second tube. But you know, I tried to cancel, and I wanted to cancel the darn tube. I don't want it anymore. But they couldn't cancel. They got stuck on hold for 3 or 4 hours, or it was a long-distance telephone call or whatever. So what this particular bill does is it basically provides consumers with information. It requires disclosures about what is actually going to be charged to you if you enter into a transaction with this particular company. And we think disclosures are the starting point, which is helpful, and it levels the playing field for the consumer. Another key thing about this legislation is that it stops data pass. As I mentioned at the start, there are transactions where you enter into a transaction with a legitimate company thinking that you're buying a product from company X. They then provide information to company Y without you knowing about it. This bill prohibits that data pass without the consumer's consent. We believe that if you want to enter into a transaction with company Y, it's your choice and you should be given that choice. And last but not least, this bill provides a fair method of cancellation. If a company is willing to take your order over the internet, you should be able to cancel over the internet. If they're willing to take your order over the phone by a toll-free number, they should accept your cancellation with a toll-free number. So all it does is provide the consumer a level opportunity, a fair opportunity to cancel a transaction and get out of receiving pain vanish cream for the rest of their life. Thank you for your time. Thank you for considering the bill, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, sir. I think we'll finish have the panel testify, and then we'll do the questions, because all three of you are advocates for the bill. John, well, Bartholomew. There we go. Okay, I'm sorry.
Members of the committee, my name is Karen Garth, and I have some visuals for you today that are going to pop up on the screen momentarily.
Could you turn it off?
It's
on the laptop.
It's not on the computer.
We have handouts too, I think, committee members.
Mm-hmm. It was up earlier.
There you go.
There's one of them.
Hannah's not going to use the name. Go
ahead. Maybe John, if you go ahead while we're waiting for that.
There we go.
Okay, well, there's the victim, Samuel Dakota Garst, my son who's in college. I got a call from him at 11 o'clock one night saying, Mom, there's a $75 charge for my credit card. And I asked quickly, what do you think I can do with it at 11 o'clock at night? And I said, trust me, I'll handle it. What happened is, and these are pictures off websites to give you a feeling of what happens. Very often in these offers, and I think Keith did a good job of outlining what happens, there's a neutral review, Web for Health. Well, that sounds like, gee, that, you know, that's a neutral magazine giving a recommendation for this. Well, it's not. It's a marketing tool. It's created by the company to have you perceive that there's a neutral review recommending that you buy Dazzle White Pro or Akai Slim, etc. And then, of course, they want you to know that this is seen all over. I understand there's some lawsuits with using these logos, NBC, CBS, CNN, etc., because it implies endorsement. Of course, they haven't gotten endorsement from these companies. Then a lot of this, this particular product is appealing to people like my son who want to keep that great smile. So obviously this very busy page is going to appeal to young people, and everybody's doing it, so why not you? And then to give you some sort of urgency, you know, you got to go fast, reserve your slot. If you don't get in now, boy, the offer's going to disappear. And amazingly enough, everyone who clicks is qualified. That's a big surprise. Terms and conditions, and this is where we get to the fine print. Now, I don't know how many of you, when you upgrade your software, when it says accept, read everything in the terms and conditions of that software, I can confess I do not, and I click accept. This is, remember, this is a 20-year-old who is going very, very, very fast through everything, and you can see the size of the print. Well, nobody's going to read that. They're doing exactly what Keith said, which is looking at the shipping and handling, $4.95, I can handle that, let me try it out. Well, the terms and conditions, if you blow it up, say, if you choose to keep your trial, your active credit card, which you have given for shipping and handling, will be billed for only $87 a month. And this is what happened to my son. And then every 30 days, should you continue to use Dazzle Smile. And then this pass-through issue, by the way, you'll also receive a trial subscription to World, oh, that's not Cub, that's World Club Fitness. And that's another $24. Now, he wasn't eventually charged for that. But you can see how easy it is to get hooked into this, thinking you're paying the shipping and handling fees and then getting billed for more. Now, my son caught it on the first month, but as I was perusing the internet, a lot of people who were complaining about this product, they didn't notice it till there were $300 or $400 on it. And, you know, they had paid that much not even knowing that they were being charged. So here's the process we went through. He sees the credit card statement. Well, there's an unknown name on it. It didn't say Dazzle Smile, which was the product he bought. If it had said Dazzle Smile, he would go, oh, got it. It was Dazzle Smile. Well, it didn't say that. It said Check Beauty or something like that. So right away, you're going, well, what was that? I didn't make that charge. I don't know what that product is. And he called. He didn't obviously have the patience to sit for 3 or 4 hours, but long enough to not get a response. Nobody answered the phone. So the next thing he did was call Wells Fargo, where he has his account, and got to the fraud division, and the person was very knowledgeable and very helpful and said, did you purchase a product where you may have had a small charge? And, you know, the light goes off in my son's head, and he goes, well, I did order this teeth whitening product, and, of course, that was the link, and so we knew it was Dazzle Smile. So then Mom took over because, of course, he was busy going to class, and I used their web chat, which is just kind of where you type in and they respond live. And the first thing was, we don't have an account on his name. Yes, you do. We don't have that address. Yes, you do. Keep looking. So that was the first layer I had to go through. You know, and I would say some people would go, oh, I guess I was wrong, and quit there. Of course, I didn't. They did agree to cancel the account, but they wouldn't refund that $75. Now, a lot of people, if they got it canceled, would probably lick their wounds and leave, but not Sam's mom. So then I called customer service, and the frontline person, I couldn't get anything out of them at all, so I ended up talking to the supervisor, and they agreed to refund that $75 if I returned the product. And interestingly enough, the woman said, and get a tracking number. So she obviously knew what the company would do, was giving me a little hint, so I did get a tracking number. Went several weeks, didn't get any refund, called again. Well, the product wasn't returned. Oh, yes, it was, and here's the tracking number. So again, subterfuge. So when I called back with a tracking number, then, you know, you go a little step at a time. They agreed to refund, but, oh, I can't push the credit card credit through. So basically, after all of that, they still did not refund the money. And this was several weeks later, and when we went back to Wells Fargo and showed them we sent the product back, Wells Fargo did that and refunded the money, and then I'm sure subtracted that from the company. I think this effort that Senator Bonamici, whose daughter experienced something similar, did a really good job in the interim. There was a good work group met, dealt with a lot of concerns that some of the companies had, you know, that were kind of tangential, dealt with those. Is it going to stop this process? Probably not. One of the key perpetrators of Dazzle Smile, Akai Berry, et cetera, is named Jesse Wilms. He's in Canada. He has an F rating with the British Columbia or Alberta Better Business Bureau. I heard they had to hire 2 or 3 additional people up there at the Better Business Bureau just to deal with complaints. And what they do is they're always changing their name. They're changing their website. It's really a marketing scam. And there's a lot of these little, you know, mom and pops out here that are sending out the product, but there's an overarching marketing plan that is very sophisticated and changes daily, weekly, et cetera. But I do think the bill is a good first step. I think it will allow you to prosecute the worst offenders. But if it doesn't work and this continues, then I think you really need to consider banning negative opt-out free trials, which is what this is called, where there's a free trial, but to get out of that, you have to do something positively. I mean, I don't think there's really any company who can, if they want to offer a free trial and they got a decent product, give it to them for shipping and handling. If they like the product, it's good, great. They can sign up. if you have a good product, you shouldn't be worried about that. But I can see where it's helpful. After this, everyone was laughing at me, but I signed up for a free trial with Ancestry.com, which is a genealogy site. I kept all my paperwork, and it was nice to have 3 months, you know, to try it out for free, no charge whatsoever. And then, you know, yes, you'd have to cancel it and because you gave them your credit card. So legitimate companies, this does work well. It allows the consumer to try something out. But there are a lot of scammers out there. So anyway, that was our experience. I did file a complaint with the Oregon Consumer Protection Division, and because I was retired, I did that with every single state in the country, and ended up talking to some of the people in other states and some of their issues, and ended up dealing with the attorney for the firm, who's no longer the attorney for the firm. So I caused just a few problems.
Thank you
very much. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. I think we'll have Mr. Perthana meet you first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a statewide consumer group with over 10,000 members around the state. And I'll be brief because things have pretty much been covered as to the issues. I'll just touch on a couple of points. You should have some written testimony from me that I emailed in. But we're very much in support of this legislation because we're seeing that consumers are losing hundreds of millions of dollars across the country and millions of dollars here in Oregon from these scams. In 2009, the Better Business Bureau actually ranked free trial offer scams as their number one consumer complaint in America. And a congressional committee noted that over a three-year period, the three largest credit card companies gave hundreds of millions of dollars back to cardholders based on complaints about just three of the companies that operate these free trial offer scams. This is a good bill that went through a good process with the work group. I participated in the work group. We had members of multiple parts of the business community that utilize free trial offers. And we came out with a good product that I believe allows good companies to still offer free trials of their product or service, but provides consumer protections so that people don't get tricked into something that they were not intending to purchase.
Thank you.
So with that, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Committee members, thank you for your testimony, panel. Representative Cameron, do you have something?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you bringing this forward. I think it was probably less than a year ago I went through a similar situation in my family with a relative, and I don't think we ever got our money back. We ended up canceling our credit card and changing credit cards to get out of the situation that we were into, and so appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
Call me next time.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've also had to cancel a credit card in the past over something like this. It is a pain. One of my concerns was the example given here. It seemed to conform to all of the things in this bill. It had the disclosure. Well, it had the disclosure at the top, and in fact, it wasn't even at the bottom. You can change the type size of things if it's live text on the web. They gave you the 800 number. You ended up canceling or trying to cancel online, which is the mechanism they used to purchase it. And then when you called, you were able to reach not only the front office person, but the supervisor. It seems like you got all of the things that this bill lays out. Am I wrong in that?
If you want. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I think in this particular instance, there's the type of font, the size of the font. So if you're going to advertise something like congratulations, you can't have, you know, and that's in 20-point type, and the little conditions are in 6. You have to have, there's some requirement that this issue of terms and conditions has to be a similar size.
This bill doesn't speak to type size at all, does it?
Well, it says...
I'd have a huge problem with it if it did.
The other issue, I think, is that you can't piggyback this World Club Fitness. So I'm going to let Keith and John answer that, but I thought there was something into the same size. I'll look for it. Let's see.
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Chair, wasn't it, Representative Sheehan?
Yeah,
the bill does talk about it requires clear and conspicuous information, meaning the language readily understandable, printed in such size, color, contrast, and location, et cetera, et cetera. So this bill does indicate that if
compared to
you have to have the disclosures, and the disclosures must be readily available and readable to the consumer.
Follow-up? Please.
So in your estimation, is that not conspicuous and not contrasting?
That is up on the screen, surely is, but if you go back a page, that's not, because it is
really?
So small. Yeah, the consumer is not going to be able to see that, not when you consider it in comparison to the rest of the typeface. The font needs to be of a similar size to the rest of the information on the page.
Go ahead. If I just offer, I have a huge problem with that then. If this is part of this, I mean, disclosures and legal notices and things like that, I mean, you can open up the newspaper and read a land use disclosure that's six-point type. I think that's readable. It definitely contrasts. As somebody who's in advertising, I can't have my clients and customers paying for space and things that have the disclosure be the majority of the message. I mean, this kid went out and looked for this. He found this message, went through the screens. He was offered all of the information that's required here. If this bill says that type size has to be the same size as the congratulations, as a big fan of free speech, as the ACLU knows, I would be totally against this bill for that reason.
Co-Chair Sheehan and members of the committee, let me go back to that Ancestry.com. When I did Ancestry.com and signed up for the free trial, there was a very clear box. Understand that if you do not cancel before the end of the 3 months, we will charge you. It was very clear. It popped up again. I think it is doable. And it says as compared to the rest of the language. I don't think, though, that little itty-bitty type at the top under this bill would qualify. It doesn't have to be, you know, it has to be similar to what you're doing in the rest of it. And Ancestry.com did that. And it was very understandable. They went out of their way to say, understand, this is a free trial, but we've got your credit card number and we're going to charge you if you don't cancel in 3 months. That shouldn't be a burden, because the only reason they're doing this is because they don't want people to see it. Ancestry.com wants you to sign up. They want you to keep going, and I'm in year three. So attest to that. These people have a crappy product. They don't want to sell the product to you. They just want to get your $75. This guy sitting in Canada doesn't have to have one single person continue that trial. All he needs is that first month. He's getting $75 for probably a $2 product. And he just has to work new and new people about it. Those companies that care about it can make it much clearer than this, and I think the bill requires it.
I'm not defending the guy in Canada for his product. I'm not defending the mechanism. I think it's arguably deceptive, but I will not support anything that forces them to match type sizes with on a disclosure versus something used to attract somebody in. I think that's a huge issue when it comes to free speech, and I can't support it.
Co-chairs and co-vice chair Sheehan, the definition of clear and conspicuous information in 292A is essentially the same language that is used in every other statute.
What
defines,
line is that?
It's on page one of the bill, lines 18 through 21. And that language, as I said, is essentially the same language that is used in any other statute that Oregon has that defines clear and conspicuous. And basically all we're saying is it needs to be of a typeface, a color, and things like that, comparable to the other language on the page. It doesn't have to be bigger, but it's got to be, the intent is so that it's not hidden. Because if you shrink it down to, and for people like me, at anything like a 0.8 or a 0.10 font, I can't read it.
And the purpose is to make sure that it's readable and easily accessible to the rest of the information on the page.
One final thing, Mr. Chair, and then I promise I'll be quiet. I do see that type size is the same size as a lot of elements on the page. If you interfere with that, and if your testimony here is that this would not be acceptable, then, again, I just have a problem with it. I think that's clear. I think that's conspicuous. There are elements on that page where the type is the exact same size. If the purpose of this is to stop that communication from being presented to the public, I just can't support it.
Co-Chair Sheehan, members, let me try one more time. This is about the fifth website you see. I mean, the fifth page you see. Every other page has said free trial in about 20-point type. So in comparison to everything there, they're saying it's free, it's free, it's free, you've qualified, and then on the last page, you've got this. Now, that's deceptive. Their clear intent is so that they have bombarded you with free trial. I don't know what else you can do. The only other thing you can do is completely say you can't do negative opt-out free trials, because I participated in this work group. I felt it was a compromise. I think there's some legitimate uses for it. But I have seen people who have done a much better job than this. And, you know, if they want to do that, they should be fair with the customers and do like Ancestry.com and make it pretty obvious. To me, this is clearly deceptive. They know people aren't going to read it because they're raking in $1 million of this, and they're not providing a product. So I think it was a compromise. It's a step in the right direction. If it doesn't do any good, then you're forced to say, okay, we're going to have to, because of the bad guys, eliminate negative opt-out free trials entirely. To me, the bill is a step in the right direction. It'll put people on notice. They can prosecute the most egregious people, and maybe some, you know, the good players will conform to this. But I think if you ask Jesse Wilds in Canada why this typeface is this way and why it's only on 1 of 5 pages, and they were honest, they'd say so people don't read it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Representative Smith.
Yeah, and man, I've definitely heard what you had to say, and I appreciate it. Keith, I have a question for you. So there's nothing in the bill that requires a typeface, but just clear and conspicuous, which might mean, you know, so it doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be the size of congratulations, for instance. And this would not be the matter for the bill. This would be a matter for implementation, but maybe the size of whatever's below that. And maybe it wouldn't even matter the size, but it might matter that it's on the first page, right, rather than, you know, 4 clicks in or several clicks in. Am I right that there's nothing that dictates a particular font size in the bill, but rather that a regular person would say, oh, yeah, it's clear and conspicuous. And I'm probably with Representative Sheehan that if that were on the first page, right, I think it's probably clear and conspicuous. I could argue that, well, maybe it should be a little bigger, maybe it should be a little more colorful. I got no objection to that, and I would defer to the people who implement this stuff and know better than I. But I would include what page it's on in my analysis of what's clear and conspicuous. But anything is how I'm understanding this correct?
Co-Chair Wisnik and Halvey and Co-Vice Chair Smith, you're correct. The statute doesn't specify the font size.
Yeah.
It has to be comparable to the other language on the page.
Okay.
The point that is important is the last clause of subsection C, which is that it's got to be in close proximity to the request for consent to a free offer. I can't read all this very well, but the intent is this. There's usually on a web page a button that you click to say, purchase, or, you know, order, or something like that. It needs to be on that page in readily readable typeface so that, you know, if you hesitate and say, before I order, I'm going to read the terms and conditions. That's all we want, is to level the playing field. If it's hidden such that it's very difficult to read, then there's a problem. If it's hidden on a page that's completely independent of the order page, then there's a problem. It has to be read into context, and I can't read the entire page here, so I can't voice an opinion upon whether it complies with the statute or not. But the goal is to make sure that disclosure is readily available to the consumer before they click on the order page.
Thanks.
If I might, members of the committee, I remembered one more thing. You can't see this here, but as you're clicking through, and you've decided to do this and you know you're going to pay $4.95 handling, what you get, if you scroll down to try to put your credit card in there, that disappears.
Okay. That has to do with your screen resolution. That's totally irrelevant.
Okay. Let's get back here. Representative Smith, are you finished?
I'm cool.
Thank you. Representative Hovey.
Thank you. I just have two short questions, I think, for Keith. Just in regards to clear and conspicuous information, are there, I mean, you mentioned that we have this particular language and throughout different statutes already for many types of things, and I think the federal government also has some references to that in some statutes for truth in lending and other types of issues. So it's the whole clear and conspicuous isn't any something new.
Co-Chair Wisnick, Co-Chair Hall, you're absolutely correct. The clear and conspicuous definition has been consistent in both Oregon law and federal law in terms of where it ought to be located. The size needs to be readily readable and not hidden. And so this is not a new definition that we're adopting under Oregon law.
Thank you. And follow-up. Okay. An unrelated question simply about, I understand that there's some references to shipping and handling charges. Is there anything in this bill that actually requires somebody who makes the free offer to actually disclose what the shipping and handling charges are in this bill? I was reading it, and I didn't actually see a requirement to disclose, though there is a reference to shipping and handling in it already. So I'm just kind of wondering.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, there, interestingly, there was a bill that I remember working on in one of the earlier sessions, either last year or 2009, that addressed the shipping and handling issue. That bill didn't move forward, and it's not specifically addressed in this bill, but this bill does require the disclosure of the total cost to the consumer so that the consumer knows actually what is going to show up on their credit card. And that would include the shipping and handling and any free product that they're eventually going to be billed for later. So the goal is to make sure the consumer knows what they're going to get billed later on.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Dubanovich, you mentioned 150 complaints. That was strictly on free offers. And do you have that broken down by age?
Co-Chair Wisnett, age of the consumer?
Yes.
I'm not sure if we collect that data. We probably do not, but I'll certainly inquire and be happy to respond to you.
I think it'd be interesting of senior age or how many kids are doing it and things and stuff like that.
Co-Chair, okay. The breakdown obviously is the internet complaints are more going to be younger people. Yep. Where the elderly get suckered in are the radio ads, television ads, and print ads.
Thank you for that testimony. Okay, panel, very good testimony. Thank you. Mr. Dooley. Good morning. Please identify yourself and give us your concise testimony.
Thank you. For the record, Mike Dooley, coming a little late to the party, I represent a company called DeHart & Dar that represents companies like Better Homes & Garden, Periodicals, Publications, Time Inc., companies like that. What I wanted to do first, in case Senate Bill 739 passes, Senator Atkinson's bill, I want to declare I am a citizen, so I want you to know that for the website. So I wanted to talk a bit about some of the issues that that we have with the bill and probably could be fixed. I do want to say, though, with regard to the clear and conspicuous language and the discussion about whether or not that was clear and conspicuous, if that isn't, we have a problem with this bill in terms of the definition. Now, there is a TWR case in 1993 that gets into the definition, and I would assume the Attorney General and others would use that. There's some language we worked a number of years ago on sweepstakes, and changing the statute there, and perhaps there's some language also there. But that would be an issue for us. The effective date of this bill is upon passage. This bill requires companies that provide free trials at a minimum to either provide a toll-free number or to cancel in a similar way in which you accepted the offer. And the first part of this question, and I haven't had a chance to talk to the AG or others about this, and I do want to say that Senator Bonamici has done a good job of collaborating with all the parties. And there were a number of work sessions, so there was a lot of light shed on this issue. But it wasn't clear to me whether or not the toll-free number was one that you had to have somebody handle the telephone calls. And so that is a question you might want to speak to. The issue we have is we would be setting up potentially, now this is again for publications and periodicals, let's say magazines or books. So what happens is, let's say that you go into a bookstore and you purchase a number of travel magazines. And a number of bookstores now do this, and they say, would you like a free trial to Travelers Magazine? And you say yes, and then you get in the mail the information about what that includes. And that information provided to you also provides how you can cancel. You can send back the invoice, you can send back, there may be a number, whatever the case may be, but the way that you had accepted that offer was not through the mail. And so this provides some concern for us in terms of the process that we would have to set up by which they could, because it's going to be this a similar way, and under this bill, we would have to set up a toll-free number, and those are somewhat expensive. So we would like to potentially talk about an amendment that would carve out periodicals and publications, and you would do it by virtue of if you're going to receive that in the mail, you cancel through a process that you're going to receive the welcome communication as to what you've bought, and what are the terms and conditions, and how do you cancel prior to the free offer expiring. So we think that is something that the committee ought to explore. The other issue that we looked at and was really not clear was on page 2, line 20 of the bill, because this is now, we're getting into the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is serious stuff. There is this term, a statement of applicable, that by accepting the free offer, and we would suggest that just have that by accepting the free offer, because I don't know what a statement of applicable means, and I'd be happy to talk to the AG about that, but I just wasn't sure exactly what that meant. I would say with regard to shipping and handling, although this bill doesn't really cover that, you have to be a little careful if you want to have that conversation, because on books, for example, if you take a series of 4 or 5 books, it's going to be very difficult to know when they accept the free offer and you're going to say this is the charge. It's going to depend on what offer they accept in terms of the number of books in a month or whatever the case may be. So we think this can be fixed, and we would bring some amendments to you very quickly if that were the will of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee members? Chair Helby.
And Mr. Dewey, I am just a little bit confused here. In listening to Senator Bonamici's testimony, this work group has been going over this for quite some time, and the bill seemed to make it out of the Senate without much objection, and were you not involved in the discussions at all?
Mr. Co-Chair, I was involved in the discussions, and I said we're coming late. For one client, we have taken care of that on the FCC exemption. With regard to this client, we've had continuing discussions about how to address this bill, and there are two bodies here, we think this needs some additional work, albeit I was there. We talked some of this language as you look at it, And oftentimes you catch issues that ought to be fixed, and it's something that when I looked at it and I said, okay, how do we go about canceling something that is going to be different in terms of the way that you accepted the free offer? I don't think what I'm offering up is anything that is going to misrepresent the consumer, because I would say that these types of offers aren't the problem. It's been radio, television. It's not the offer through the mail, the information when you're receiving something through the mail. That hasn't been the issue.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're proposing an exemption to this bill for free offers that are made through the mail.
No, Mr. Co-Chair, what I would be doing is have this be applicable. This bill would be applicable to periodicals, magazines, and so forth. But the way that you could cancel the information that's provided through to the consumer would be noticed through the mail, as opposed to through the internet or through a toll-free number. So we would still be in the bill. There would still be notification, but it would be through the mail.
Other questions, committee members? Okay, thank you, and we'll look forward to the discussion.
Thank you for your time.
And, I would appreciate the Department of or the AG's office on this emergency clause. That didn't seem, if we're going to be setting policy like this, the emergency clause, how locked into we are on that. So we can talk offline on that. Any other comments on this bill, committee members? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 292A. Committee members, I'm going to, the co-chair, Hobie, and I agree to carry over. We're going to carry over Senate Bill. Number 908A to the next meeting. Is there any other business to come before that? I don't have to gavel that.
No.
Any other committee comments or meeting or discussion? If not, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.